Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Claire Woodcock. Colorado voting records are turned over to the Trump administration as it looks for vulnerabilities in our voting system.
CNN host Fareed Zakaria tells us about the roots of increasing polarization in our country.
Climate scientists have some big, some might even say mammoth, ideas about saving permafrost in the Arctic.
And we sit down to talk with John Lovett, co-host of the podcast Pod Save America and former speechwriter for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
If you voted in Colorado, the Trump administration wants to know about it. Allison Bechtesh reports.
Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams announced last week that he will be turning over all public voting records to the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. President Trump established the commission in May to study voter registration systems throughout the country and each community's voting process. Williams is turning over a list of all registered Colorado voters, their party affiliation, birth year, and records of which elections they participated in. The commission is chaired by Vice President Pence, who will submit a report to the president regarding vulnerabilities in the country's voting system. A growing list of states are refusing to turn over voter registration data. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
As Pitkin County Open Space and Trails, staff works to design a trail up the Crystal River Valley, a local conservation organization wants to make sure wildlife is protected.
Wilderness Workshop has hired biologist Rick Thompson to study potential impacts to wildlife, especially as planners work on trail alignment through sensitive habitat. Will Rausch is conservation director for Wilderness Workshop.
It really comes down to getting the science right.
Pitkin County and the U.S. Forest Service are also conducting studies, which will consider cost, engineering, and safety, in addition to wildlife impacts. Thompson will present his findings at public meetings next week.
Things are in limbo after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell delayed a vote last week on the GOP effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Based on what's in the Senate bill right now, Benta Berkland spoke with Joe Hannell of the nonpartisan Colorado Health Institute to break down what the numbers could mean for residents and the state's budget.
Wanted to first touch on Medicaid expansion. What does it mean here, and what will happen to potentially that population if they don't have health insurance?
Our analysts here have built a model that projects out to the year 2030. Given what we know about our current Medicaid population, how much spending happens and how much it's increasing, and then what the new bill says and what it says it would fund. And we find that Colorado state government could expect $15 billion less in funding from the feds. As a result, probably about 630,000 fewer Coloradans would be on Medicaid by the end of the next decade. That's a big chunk of the state population. Those folks would probably be uninsured because before the expansion happened with the Affordable Care Act, a lot more people were uninsured. Most of them got coverage through Medicaid because they couldn't afford it anyway else. There are a couple of different things this bill does with Medicaid. First, it rolls back that Affordable Care Act expansion. That touches mostly on able-bodied adults who didn't qualify before the Affordable Care Act. These are folks who make less than $16,000 or so a year. The part of Medicaid that was here before Obamacare was in place, what the bill would do for them is cap costs at some base number and then inflate the cost each year by a predetermined amount. And if the number doesn't keep pace with medical costs and the cost of nursing home care, then you're going to have a funding shortfall. And our current model predicts exactly that funding shortfall. Colorado legislators and whoever the new governor is would have to decide, what are we going to do to bridge this? Are we going to radically cut services for kids? Are we going to disqualify some people from joining up?
How does it work for folks on the individual market now? That's not as big of a population, but we've had very high premiums in parts of the state, especially in the mountains. Not a lot of insurers to choose from. Let's say Obamacare stays in place or it goes away. Are things going to look better for those folks?
It was looking as though the markets were starting to stabilize. Stabilizing in not a great spot where there's not a whole lot of choices for people in rural Colorado, then their prices are higher than they are for folks along the Front Range. But at least it looked like we were going to get out of these 25% yearly price increases. now, regardless of what happens with this bill, we might be looking at some bigger price increases next year, because what insurers around the country and in Colorado are saying is that some of the Affordable Care Act mechanisms that shore up the insurance market, they're not sure if they'll be funded. And then it would depend on who you are under this bill, if you would do better off or worse. The Senate bill pushes people toward cheaper insurance that covers less. It also allows insurers to charge less for younger people, but more for older people.
One of the centerpieces of Obamacare, the individual mandate requiring people to purchase health insurance or face a financial penalty, this proposal would do away with that, but yet there would still be an incentive for folks to have health insurance.
Yes, at least in theory. The reason that Obamacare put in the individual mandate, which is probably the least popular part of it and the most controversial, if you're going to require insurance companies to sell insurance to anybody, you have to make sure everybody buys it. Otherwise, only sick people will buy insurance and the insurance companies will quickly go broke. The individual mandate didn't prove to be really effective. A lot of younger, healthier people still have not bought insurance. Well, the Senate came up with this idea that if you don't have insurance for a couple of months and you want to get insured again, then you have to apply and wait 6 months before your insurance kicks in. It would be an incentive to maintain insurance. Well, the Congressional Budget Office looked at it and said it might have some positive effect on getting people to be insured, but it's so small that they couldn't even build it into their models. It's an idea that we haven't seen tested on a really large scale or any scale that I know of. So we don't know if it would work or not.
That was Joe Hanel, an analyst with the Colorado Health Institute. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Plans for the Gorsuch House Hotel were put on hold this spring when Aspen City Council voted to suspend its review of the project. That doesn't mean that the development is out of view, however. A mailer from the Gorsuch team was sent to all Aspen voters this June, and the 4th of July parade featured a Gorsuch House float. Reporter Allison Bektesh has been checking in with the players. She talked to producer Kristen Kay about where the project sits right now.
Remind us what the Gorsuch House plans are all about.
This year alone, we've seen two different proposals from Norway Island LLC, led by Jeff Gorsuch. The basic premise is that the group wants to build a hotel at the base of the west side of Aspen Mountain, on land that they would buy from the Aspen Skiing Company. To sweeten that land sale, they would also build office space for SkiCo and replace Lift 1A.
And that's where the biggest hang-up is, right?
Right. So Gorsuch took into consideration early criticism of their design. But in the end, the conversation kept coming back to the placement of the new lift, which in the Gorsuch plans was on their land, but many think it would be better for the access point to actually be further into town.
Is that realistic?
There are a lot of reasons to think no, according to Aspen's Peanut Gallery. But what was decided was to ask the experts. The city has now contracted with a consultant, SE Group, to look at potential lift configurations, how they would operate, and what regulations need to be considered. As this analysis is going on, Gorsuch is standing by, but they're not the only ones with their eye on the results. Jen Phelan, the city planner who is overseeing the application, told me that some conceptual ideas from the consultants have already been shared, not only with Gorsuch House, but also with the Aspen Skiing Company and another player, Gorsuch's direct neighbor to the north, which is further into town, Lift One Lodge.
And what's happening with Lift One?
Lift One plans have been approved by the city, but construction hasn't started yet, so theoretically, those plans could change and the lift could be placed lower. Earlier this spring, Michael Brown, who's the principal of the development group behind Lift One, asked council to extend the approvals on his development. He's waiting to see the results from that lift analysis, and that's a clue that maybe there will be some schematic changes in order to accommodate that lower lift. My question would be, what would they want in return?
Well, what's on the table?
One reason why all of this is so controversial is that none of this neighborhood is zoned for tall, high-density buildings. But all spring, we heard from City Council that a zoning variance might be worth a brand new lift. So one thing up for bargaining is the scale of new developments. The city has already approved nearly $20,000 from the general fund for this lift study, but Phelan told me that even more brainstorms are brewing, and they may ask the consultants to widen their scope. The suspense is killing me. I know it's also killing our listeners. We expect to see some clues coming out by the end of this summer or early in the fall.
Okay, we'll look for those discussions between the city, the developers, and the ski company to become public in a month or two.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Zevry. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Starting tonight, the play Sex with Strangers will begin its run in Repertory with Theatre Aspen's main stage production of the musical Hairspray.
In a world where technology dominates the dating game, is modern love meant to be a public or private endeavor? That's the question playwright Laura Eason addresses in the play Sex with Strangers. This summer, Theatre Aspen is providing its own take on the play under the tent in Rio Grande Park. Marcus Potter is Theatre Aspen's interim artistic director. He proclaims the play to be an important investigation of love in the information age.
Can intimacy exist in this new digital age when we're glued to our devices, when where love is found on devices, where there's limited human interaction, a diminishing of human intimacy? Can love exist in this environment?
Theatre Aspen's run of Sex with Strangers begins with a preview tonight at 8 p.m., another tomorrow at 3 p.m., followed by the show's opening tomorrow night at 7 p.m.
Last week, Carbondale Town Trustees granted the new City Market project a sixth extension. Wyatt Orm has more.
Joel Starbuck is a division real estate manager with City Market. He compared the company's corporate offices to a bank and said the bank wasn't giving him any more money right now. He wasn't sure when the money for the new store will become available, if at all. To possibly explain the siphoning off of funds, Starbuck reminded the trustees of Amazon's recent purchase of Whole Foods, which has large corporate grocers proceeding cautiously. He asked for and was granted a 90-day extension to buy himself more time. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
This month, Claire has seen an influx of politically themed theatrical performances in the Valley. She joined producer Kristen Kay in the studio to discuss this trend.
Where are you seeing art with some kind of political message thriving in particular?
Definitely in the theater, for sure. The Aspen Fringe Festival at the beginning of the month featured a lineup that included an adaptation of Mike Daisy's one-man show, The Trump Card, and a new play called Angry Allen from British playwright Penelope Skinner got its world premiere at the festival, too. That one's about a man grappling with the right-wing culture that has formulated online since, like, even going back to before the election. And then the decision to bring the musical Hairspray to Theatre Aspen as its main stage production this season was an effort to generate often difficult discussions about race in this country. And then at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week, the Curious Theatre Company from Denver revived its production of this new play called Building the Wall. The playwright behind it, Robert Schenken, was in town last week to discuss the dystopian play he wrote last year, which also grapples with issues of immigration.
So you did attend Ideas Fest sessions last week. What did you hear there about how politics are intersecting with the arts?
So the Aspen Ideas Festival had this entire track of events operating under the umbrella concept, the art of change. So all of those panel discussions grappled with the societal impact that art can have. And since Damian Wotzel has been the head of the Institute's arts program, he's been very conscious about integrating the arts into larger frameworks that the Institute provides. One of the events I attended was called The Producer, From Rent to Hamilton and Beyond, featuring Jeffrey Seller. And all of these musicals deal with race, sex, and socioeconomic issues.
What makes theater an especially effective platform for inciting these socially conscious conversations?
Well, I think there's something immersive in seeing something unfold in a live setting over the course of 90 minutes or less or longer. It's hard to bring a theatrical production to life. Sometimes scripts can read as stilted, which can make an actor or director's job more difficult. But the topics and themes emerging out of this season's summer production schedule are fluid in that they're dealing with societal issues close to a lot of people's lives in the Valley and throughout the country. So this summer's series of performances are more connected to reality.
Fareed Zakaria is the host of CNN's GPS, or Global Public Square. He's also a columnist for The Washington Post. He was at the Ideas Festival last week and talked about the roots and future of populism. Barbara Platts caught up with him on the Aspen Institute campus to discuss more about the polarization in our country.
At your talk yesterday, you talk about our society's inability to connect. Can you briefly explain that?
Sure. The big problem in America today is that our political identities have become more an expression of our socioeconomic identities than policy differences. We increasingly live with people we agree with politically. We tend to watch media that reaffirms those biases. And as a result of that, we've created these sort of almost two teams. And it's very difficult to bridge that gap, to think well of the other person. We've got to find a way to make it more about policy disagreements, which is really what these are at the end of the day.
Is it our responsibility to break this cycle?
I strongly believe that there should be organizations like NPR and the public radio system in general, I would argue like CNN, that try very hard to present objective reality, objective facts, that work very hard on real reporting, and that try to present both perspectives. Inevitably, there is going to be some level of bias because human beings are human beings. But on the whole, at least you're trying, and you're trying to present both sides. I'd like to believe those would be the most important organizations, that would be the most respected. That's not really where we are as a country right now. But I still think the effort is important enough that those of us who do it should keep doing it and keep trying to do it, because if we give up on that, we're giving up on democracy.
You even said that oftentimes some people don't respond to facts. So should we still be dealing in facts?
Look, I think we have to. There's a segment of America that believes that they're talked down to by elite urban experts. And that's a problem. There is this kind of socioeconomic divide. But we can't, as a result, throw away the idea that facts are important, that data is important. I think we have to do it in a way that is maybe more respectful, is less condescending, is more inclusive. But we can't abandon the idea of facts and knowledge and expertise.
But at the same time, we have to make it mix with that gut feeling, like you said about Bernie Sanders and even Trump, that people are gauging from their gut, not necessarily because of facts.
I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make, is that we think that most people, this is not, you know, a kind of class thing, it's just most people make decisions about politics analytically. Yeah. They don't. They make decisions emotionally and through the gut, and they make decisions and kind of asking themselves, is this candidate like me? Being authentic, being yourself, that's what Bernie Sanders had more than anything else. And frankly, that's what Donald Trump had in many ways. Trump was who he was, and he was unapologetic about it. And it's not a surprise that they did so well. And there's a lesson to be drawn from that. And it's on the left and the right.
What role would you say that trust plays?
Trust is very important. Trust is at the heart of the media's relationships with its audience. It's at the heart of government. We work very hard to make sure every fact is nailed down, everything we say. And I try very hard to be fair and balanced, by which I mean I do try to look at a proposal that Donald Trump will make and say, forget about the fact that it came from Donald Trump. Is it a good proposal? You have to try to convey to people that you're looking at this stuff fairly. But it also extends, by the way, to government. You cannot have a situation where the president of the United States is trashing the FBI, trashing intelligence agencies, and then says, we're going to have to do more strikes in Syria because his intelligence is telling him that there are dangers creeping in those places. But that's the same intelligence agencies he's just been demeaning.
Lastly, would you ever consider running for public office?
You know, my mom sometimes tells me that, and I get that from people. Look, I think the truth of the matter is I'm very good at what I do with all humility. I've done it for 25 years. I don't know that I'd be good. Being a politician is very hard. I have a lot of respect for politicians. My dad was a politician, and I know how difficult it is to play that game. I also think, to be totally honest, I could have imagined doing it at a time when my identity wouldn't have been so important. When I came to America, and until very recently, most of my viewers had no idea about my national origins, my religion, and that was the great thing about America. You know, Ronald Reagan once said, Americans don't care about your origins, they care about your destination. In the last couple of years, people have gotten very focused on your name, what, you know, where do you come from, what religion are you? I don't want to be in that political space. I've never tried to play an identity card. I don't know whether it would play well or badly. I suspect it would play badly, given my name and brown skin and all that. But regardless, it's not who I am. It's not really how I define myself. And I would hate to be pushed into that box. So I think I'll do what I do. And as I say, I try to do something important. And I'm going to keep trying as long as people let me.
You can hear more of this conversation, as well as Zakaria's full Aspen Ideas Festival lecture, at aspenpublicradio.org.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Claire Woodcock. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
On Monday, the Garfield County Commissioner signed a letter encouraging the Bureau of Land Management to allow more drilling at the base of the Rhone Plateau. Wyatt Orm has more.
The energy company that wants to drill is called Terra. It wants to drill just over 60 new wells in an area called the Balzac Gulch, about 9 miles west of Rifle. Terra already has a big extraction operation in the area. They would drill the new wells from their existing well pads. The BLM is currently assessing the proposal. Garfield's three commissioners signed a letter in support of the project. The letter stressed just how much the county depends on oil and gas revenue to provide services like fire departments and education. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
As scientists work to understand and address a changing climate, some are exploring creative and unusual approaches. Elizabeth sat in on a discussion about climate moonshots at last week's Ideas Festival, and she spoke with Kristen Kay about what she heard.
Elizabeth, you heard scientists discussing resurrecting woolly mammoths. What does that mean? Are we headed for another Jurassic Park?
Not exactly, but there are some similarities. So the Arctic is full of mammoth bones that have DNA intact that scientists can extract and then use to genetically modify elephants so that they develop mammothy characteristics like thick fur that would help them survive Arctic winters. So it's not exactly like creating a mammoth from scratch from this DNA, but it would be genetically modifying elephants. And it's Russian scientists who've proposed this wild idea. There's a research center actually called Pleistocene Park where they're working on restoring the ecosystem that supported mammoths.
That's incredibly cool, but why? Why is this being discussed? How are mammoths connected to climate change?
Well, it all has to do with permafrost. So a researcher at the Woods Hole Research Center, Max Holmes, studies permafrost. Permafrost is the layer of earth that is permanently frozen, or at least has been frozen for more than 2 years, often much longer than that. Permafrost contains a lot of carbon. So if the permafrost melts, scientists like Max Holmes are concerned that that release of carbon into the atmosphere will vastly accelerate climate change.
What's the connection between woolly mammoths and permafrost?
There are a few different ideas here, but the part of the Arctic that scientists are interested in is often covered with snow, and snow insulates the ground. Mammoths are really big, so when they...
They're mammoths.
So when they walk on the snow, it compacts and reduces some of that insulating power of snow, so the colder air temperature might permeate further into the ground, keeping the permafrost frozen for longer.
This did not go well in Jurassic Park. What are some of the ethical concerns being raised about this?
It's not like scientists are starting from scratch or with an established species like they were when they were cloning sheep. Instead, they're changing genes in elephants, and there are some social concerns that are specific to elephants. Jacqueline Gill, who's a paleoecologist, spoke about concerns about those first few resurrected mammoths would not have a culture to learn and understand.
Well, at this point, it's still a moonshot, right?
Right, exactly. I don't think we're going to have a mammoth in the streets of Aspen anytime soon. We'll have to leave that to the moose. John Lovett is a former speechwriter for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. He's a co-founder of Crooked Media, a left-leaning media company bent on inspiring grassroots political action. He's also co-host of the popular podcast Pod Save America and host of his own podcast, Love It or Leave It. He was in town for the Ideas Festival and performed a live show at the Belly Up. He sat down with Wyatt Orm. They began by discussing how he and his fellow hosts use humor on Pod Save America.
You guys are very funny together. You have a really good dynamic. It's very friendly. You appear to be very good friends.
All performance. We can't stand each other. We don't say a word after
I was going to ask if it's affected at all, but I just want to assume that it's not.
Okay.
So don't answer that question. So it's very playful, and at the same time, the goal at least appears to be creating activism or creating more civic engagement. Do you ever worry that the playfulness can kind of undermine a call to action?
No. We really did want to have the kind of conversation on the podcast that John and Tommy and Dan and I have when nobody's recording it.
Yeah.
And that's a conversation that's irreverent, that makes fun of things that are serious because it's the way you get through it. And this is going to be a long slog, right? We are, 160 days into the Trump administration, so we've just crossed the 10% mark. We need to stay vigilant. We need to stay active. We need to stay passionate. We need to stay engaged. But we also have to stay sane. And it's really hard. It's really hard. This is a really scary, frightening, dispiriting time.
Have you ever heard from kind of a more diverse political group than just young liberal city dwellers.
Yes. We hear from conservatives all the time that say they like the show and they listen to hear from the other side, and even more people that maybe weren't involved in politics at all. You know, people ask us, you know, are you just preaching to the choir? And part of this is a conversation of people of like mind, but also it's about getting at people who might have sat out the election or might be just getting involved.
Right.
People are more engaged with politics right now than I have ever seen. And that is powerful, right? People are marching. People are doing things. People are calling.
If Democrats don't make headway in 2018, have you guys failed?
I think that gives us way, way too much credit. One of the most important ways that we can hold Trump accountable and prevent some of the most draconian and backwards looking policies is by taking the House. And so we're going to do everything we can to help. Beyond that, you know, it's we're a small part of this.
Right. I mean, kind of like considering your background, you were previously a speechwriter for Barack Obama. You've also written for.
And I was a writer for Hillary Clinton.
And you were a writer for Hillary Clinton. So you have a long history in politics. As you look back, and granted that hindsight's always 20/20, do you feel as if you can sort of look back and see indications that we were headed this direction?
I think that, look, I'd be lying if I said I thought we'd be sitting here and Donald Trump would be president of the United States. Right. But one thing that I felt all along is that Donald Trump is, in many ways, a physical, reified embodiment of what is broken in our culture. He is reality TV. He is get what you can for yourself because the rules don't matter. And if you don't, you're a sucker. And on top of that, there has been a generation of politicians that have not spoken to the angst and anxiety and changing way of life for millions and millions and millions of people. And Donald Trump just came right up the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I want to ask you about that because, I mean, and this is just trying to localize this discussion a little bit, but like you're in Aspen, Colorado right now, you're in Pickens County. It's kind of a Democratic stronghold in what is otherwise a pretty conservative place. And how did Democrats prove to working white people that they care?
Yeah. I think that's a really big challenge that for reasons that have to do with right-wing media, that have to do with Democratic failings, I think it's a hard, long road of again, this a simple, elegant vision for what Democrats care about. Donald Trump appealed to the so-called white working class by basically reminding them that they were white. And what we need to do as Democrats is we need to appeal to these people by reminding them that they're working. Democrats need to accept that we have lost everywhere. We have lost at the local level, the state level, the federal level, and the presidency. We are in the wilderness, and we need to figure out why.
John Lovett, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
John Lovett is a former presidential speechwriter and the co-host of Pod Save America and the host of Love It or Leave It. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Claire Woodcock. To hear the show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.